This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, mother and daughter Jeannie and Dana Scott talk about how their lives changed after Dana came out as a lesbian. But first, the arrest of a Kalamazoo doctor by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents has brought new attention in Southwest Michigan to the issue of immigration and deportation. The first reporting of the story of Lucas Neese came soon after a Detroit-area man was deported to Mexico. Jorge Garcia came to the United States when he was 10 and was deported after 30 years in this country. We're going to discuss what these cases tell us about immigration with Susan Reed. She is the managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Thank you for being here, Susan.
Thank you, Gordon.
I want to go back to something that you said to Channel 3 regarding Dr. Neese, that you said that this was an example of the system working as it was designed to work. How so?
Sure. Well, and just to be very clear, you know, my office is not representing Dr. Neese, and I don't have any more information about that situation than other folks do. But based on the sort of basic framework, which is a person who is a lawful permanent resident being detained by immigration and charged with deportation, apparently based on old criminal convictions, right, that ICE will be alleging meet the standard for deportation.
Going back about 25 years. Right.
Exactly. Going back in this case, quite a long time and to some degree, an unusually long time. That is the system that we have. Non-citizens are very vulnerable to deportation. In 1996, a large number of new grounds for removal were added to the law. And those included, for example, virtually any controlled substance conviction other than possession of 30 grams or less of marijuana, and a number of other types of convictions that made people deportable. And again, just to give you an example of how this system was designed to work, people who pled guilty to perhaps cocaine possession as a youth or possession of more than 30 grams of marijuana at a time when it was not a deportable offense, became deportable in 1996. And so I think one of the things that surprised people most, right, was this idea of, well, but these convictions were so long ago. Our system was designed to have that not matter if at any time. Not only does the government, if at any time the government becomes aware of something, they can pursue deportation, but if at any time after a conviction, the government freshly makes that a ground of deportation, you can be prosecuted for deportation. So it's a system that is really designed to be extremely punitive, and it's not a system that's designed to have a lot of consideration of equities.
And one of the things that we have found out about Dr. Neese's case is that ICE says this sort of came onto their radar because of encounters that he had with the police over the years, 18 of them. Some of these are speeding tickets. Some of these are things which are a little more serious. But is it a combination of these two things, or is that what it appears to be to you, that it's these two convictions from long ago plus these so-called encounters with police?
Yeah, you know, there are lots of ways that people come to ICE's attention long after a criminal conviction makes them deportable, or come to ICE's attention because they actually just don't have a status. And, you know, a couple of common examples would be green cards have to be renewed every 10 years. So after that 1996 law that I mentioned earlier, all of a sudden in 2006, people go to renew their green cards and, oh, this conviction that's 10, 15, 20 years old is suddenly coming onto the radar for the first time. Another thing that frequently gets folks put into deportation proceedings is actually when they apply for citizenship or apply for green cards and don't end up being eligible. Those cases often get referred to ICE. So I always think that's interesting when people say, oh, well, you know, why didn't this person just apply for citizenship? Well, often if you don't have the right advice, the right analysis, the right knowledge, or the government gets it wrong, it's applying for citizenship that gets you put into deportation proceedings. But in this case, I thought it was particularly chilling to hear this language come from Immigration and Customs Enforcement that apparently what prompted their action was that there had been police encounters. You know, our Constitution promises us due process, and I don't know what a police encounter is. I've been practicing immigration law for 15 years. It's not a special immigration law term. I don't think my colleagues who do criminal defense exactly know what a police encounter is. And so to see the government taking action that could be devastating against a person based on this number of police encounters, how many encounters is too many, Gordon? Can you get 5 speeding tickets before you get put in deportation proceedings? Can you only get 2? If the police come and ask me a question and I answer it, is that a police encounter? What if I don't answer it? Is that a police encounter? I found that language of police encounter as the impetus for this prosecution to be very unsettling from a civil liberties perspective.
You mentioned that there should be due process. How quickly can things move in terms of deportation, and is there adequate time for an organization, maybe like the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, to provide an adequate defense for someone who may be facing deportation?
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges. One reason we get involved at all is because, unlike in criminal proceedings where the Supreme Court has said that due process requires that an attorney be appointed for you if you cannot afford your own attorney, that does not apply in immigration proceedings. They're
considered civil. So you don't necessarily get a public defender.
Absolutely not, no. And so there are people who are detained and deported who never, ever speak with an attorney about any defense that they might have to their deportation, about any civil rights violations that might have happened in the context of their detention. And actually, even if your Fourth Amendment rights to be free from unreasonable search and seizure are violated by ICE, you have to show that it was an egregious violation in order for that to defend you against your deportation. So it's not like on Law and Order, right, where if Lenny and the boys make some mistakes, then the DA gets after them because it messes up the prosecution. Often when ICE makes mistakes, it doesn't really have an impact on the prosecution. So there's a real incentive problem there. In terms of other challenges, the detained docket actually moves really pretty quickly. The wait right now for a bond hearing is very long, and I think we saw that come forward in this local case where it takes about a month to get a bond hearing. But your actual process moves reasonably quickly, and if you can afford counsel, or if there's a well-funded nonprofit able to assist you, which most of the time, unfortunately, there is not, about 90% of people who are detained don't end up having counsel. If that all happens, if you're detained, the process moves relatively quickly, you know, with time to prepare your case. Non-detained people in immigration proceedings, the cases take years. I have court dates scheduled for 2020.
I want to talk a little bit about the case of Jorge Garcia.
Sure.
Over in Detroit. Someone who came to the United States at the age of 10. He was here 30 years before he was deported. How common is this, and is it likely to be more common if there is going to be stepped up enforcement?
Well, a case like Jorge Garcia's got significantly less common in 2012 when President Obama created the DACA program. The problem for Jorge Garcia is he was actually too old to benefit from DACA. Folks had to be under 30 to benefit from DACA. And so that creates an interesting dynamic where here's Jorge Garcia in the U.S. since he was 10 years old, older than most DACA recipients. So by most calculations, you'd think, gosh, well, this guy has more equities, to use the legal term, right? He's been here longer. He has his family. But he was outside of the DACA program because he was too old. If that doesn't seem fair, well, welcome to the immigration system. You know, so for the people, though, who did manage to be in that DACA group, President Obama's 2012 decision to initiate the deferred action program for that specific group of people who did have, who and still do, right, have so many equities, did stop a lot of those folks from being put in deportation proceedings, right? And what would that have looked like? Well, in Jorge Garcia's case, he applied for a green card through his U.S. citizen wife. I think most people who watch movies, right, think that if you marry a citizen, you get a green card. A lot of people don't even seem to think there's an application process, right? It's just magic. But in fact, lots of undocumented people, even though they marry citizens, even though they have citizen children, are not eligible for green cards, are not eligible for citizenship. And like I mentioned earlier, it's applying that triggers the enforcement. I would say Jorge Garcia's case is uncommon in that he just missed that DACA threshold, and DACA has been protecting so many people for the past 5 years. but 122 people lose DACA every day since the Trump administration's September 5th decision to terminate the program. And starting on March 5th, many more, many thousands of people will lose their DACA every day. And, you know, really just to underline one more thing, again, because it gets a little circular, right? I'm just seeing a lot of why didn't they apply for citizenship? They're not eligible for citizenship. They applied for the first legalization program they were eligible for, the DACA program, and that's what they're asking for.
Once someone is deported, of course, Jorge Garcia's family is hoping that they're going to be able to get him back here. But once somebody is out of the country, how tough is it then to get back, you know, regardless of, you know, even if there's a change in law or there's a new court ruling, how tough is it to get them back here and get back to square one?
It can be very difficult. And that's why that family, you know, fought every year for discretion following him being ordered deported and received that discretionary grant from the Obama administration every year for, I believe, the past 6 years. Again, I'm not counsel in that case either, but I'm more familiar with it. It can be very difficult for a number of reasons. A deportation order generally comes with a 10-year bar to reentering the United States. In some cases, it's a 20-year bar, and that bar can only be waived in certain circumstances. There is an application process for a waiver. Some immigrants may trigger other bars when they depart the U.S. that have to do with prior unlawful presence. That wouldn't be the case probably in Jorge Garcia's case, but I suppose it could be. Again, it's not my case. In his case, I assume that the family will begin the process of seeking those waivers, but it can take years.
Oftentimes in the whole discussion of immigration policy, there's this talk of sort of a middle ground where maybe some people don't actually have a pathway to citizenship, but they can stay here legally. And there's a lot of, you know, guest worker programs and those sort of things. But I wonder if these examples that we've talked about, Dr. Neese and Jorge Garcia, if they maybe don't demonstrate that if you are not a citizen, there is some limbo there. That is, citizenship is probably the only way to get yourself firmly on the other side of not being someone who can be deported.
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of our core values at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center is equity for immigrants and immigrant communities. I think equity is an American value. And to put people in a position, which I totally acknowledge, you know, there are movement voices who said we should have just taken work permits a long time ago and we wouldn't be suffering the way we are now. And I really listen to and respect that perspective, that going for the brass ring of citizenship has just not been attainable and has left people vulnerable. I think some hidden concerns in addition to the ones you mentioned, that ongoing vulnerability to deportation, is a scenario that I'm seeing a lot, which is aging undocumented parents of U.S. citizens, right? Not eligible for Medicare, not eligible for Medicaid, no Social Security. You know, we often have that call from that family that says, we are paying cash for my mom's dialysis because she's undocumented. She can't work anymore. How can we get, often it's the dialysis center, honestly, calling to say, how can we get this person's status so we can get them this health care that they need? Well, you know, the first bit of bad news is there's usually not a way to do that. And then the second bit of bad news is, even if we found that green card needle in the haystack, you're not eligible for Medicaid until you've had your green card for 5 years. So as I see a generation of people who have worked incredibly hard in some of the most dangerous industries in our country, aging and dealing with the same human disability and age-related challenges that we all face, I see a generation of, in this community, predominantly Latino families entrenched in poverty because the costs of caring for their aging undocumented loved ones are going to prevent them from investing in their children's education, investing in homes. That's a phenomenon that I see that's real. And so I really think that a path to citizenship is an important value, even as politically challenging as that is appearing right now.
Susan Reed is the managing attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. As always, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.